Last week we introduced a series of lessons that we're going to begin this morning because we showed that we live in a world of doubt and uncertainty, especially when it comes to spiritual things. And Satan's one of his primary jobs is to destroy faith in each of us by creating doubt, which leads to despair, so we just give up. But to fight back, we have to understand there are some things we can know assuredly. And assuredly means without reservation, with total conviction. We know they're true. They were true yesterday, they'll be true today, and they'll be true forever. Jesus said there is this source of knowledge of truth. He said, if you abide in my words, then you'll truly be disciples of mine. And you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And so that's what we want to do, is look at some fundamental truths that have been left for us. They're going to set a foundation for our life. And the first one we want to talk about is the fact that we can know there is a God. You say, well, why is that so necessary to know there's a God? Well, because God is under attack in our society, the secular world in which we live. So we're going to look at it in two parts. This morning, we'll just look at just the attitude that you must have in order to know there's a God. And it's a personal faith that you can have. And it's reasonable to have one. So you have to have that confidence, okay, to believe in God. Then we'll look at some rational reasons to believe in his God as well. But the world around us asks this question, is there really a God? Now, if you're going to university and you're off to especially a liberal school, you're going to get asked this question over and over and over again. And even though statistics show that some 70 to 80%, depends on which survey you're looking at, of people say they believe in a God, when you get to a university, it seems like you're only surrounded by those people that doubt, especially the professors and other people in academia. They're going to challenge you, why do you believe in a God? And they're going to say things like, science is upstairs in the brain, faith is downstairs in the heart, and there's no ladder between the two, suggesting that there's no reasonable connection that you can make scientifically that there is a God. So what are you left thinking? Well, maybe there isn't one. Now, this is not nothing new. We could look back in 66. I mean, you weren't born there, I know that. But, you know, Time magazine asks the question, is God dead? Bertrand Russell, you know, a father of humanism, or a very strong humanist, the whole conception of God is a conception derived from Oriental despotism. I'm not going to be able to talk today. In other words, people that lord themselves over others. They made it up, is what they're saying, and it's a conception quite unworthy of free men. In other words, if you were smart enough, you'd realize there's not a God. Only fools believe there is a God. Friedrich Nietzsche, God is dead. This is his quote he's famous for. God remains dead, and we've killed him. Now, sadly, a lot of people believe that. You don't have to look very far, and God is dead in our culture, isn't he? And so the question is, are we the ones that are crazy? And so we have a plethora of books that are written by atheists, and we call them strong atheists, such as Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion. I've looked through his book, I have it, and you need to be aware of their arguments they're using. And then here, this other one, Why There Is No God. Christopher Hitchens is a great atheist, an atheist that has a lot of notoriety, that debates theists, and he says, God is not great. Now, how are you going to counter those things? And so you hear so much. Well, look what Dawkins says. Faith is a great cop-out. The great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. When you don't have evidence, what do? Oh, just believe. Now, he just dissed everyone in this room that says there's a God. Says, you do not think. The only reason you have faith is because you can't think. Now, when you're young and impressionable, especially going to school, or you're working around peers that all have this attitude, it's easy to start doubting your faith in God. So that's why we have to start here. It all starts with, is there a God? And so the question we're going to ask ourselves, you know, are we the ones that are fools? And that's interesting. God's already spoken to that matter, hasn't he? Through the psalmist, when he says, the fool is the one, the fact that says there is no God. So which is it? Are you a fool for believing in God? Are you a fool for rejecting his existence? So we have to start there. And so what we want to address this morning is just a simple idea that having a faith is reasonable. Having a faith, a personal faith in God, is reasonable. Now, we'll give the reason for it next week. But if you don't have a disposition, you're open to just considering the idea there is a God, it doesn't matter how much evidence is shown you. Because if you're closed to the idea that there is no God, there is a God, and you've already decided that it's impossible for God to exist, it's impossible for miracles to happen, doesn't matter what we show you, you're going to just laugh it off as just a fool. Just like many of you laughed this when we started our service, when I talked about how the commentator on TV said, it's just a coincidence that during the lunar eclipse, the moon is the right distance, so it looks just the same size as the sun. But that's their attitude that predetermines their conclusion. And so we have to have an open heart. And that's what I want to show us, that faith is reasonable. We love this man, Galileo, because he went against the norms and the convention that day. The Catholic Church even taught that the solar system all rotated around the earth. We were the center of everything because God created us. And he said, no, that's not the case. That actually all the planets rotate around the sun. He was eventually put to death, but he started a revolution. Here's his quote. I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason and intellect has intended us to forego their use. Now what's he saying? God gave you brain, use it. It's okay. In other words, when it comes to the proving the existence of God, there is reason that we can appeal to. There's logic. It's reasonable. Now, later it has to move from the head to the heart. Because if your God only exists in your brain and you don't trust him with all your life, you can't be a follower of Christ, but that's a secondary matter. We're just talking about, is it reasonable for you to believe in God? Now, when we look at this, we have to understand that some of the propositions that the world is selling are not true. For example, one of them is, any scientist, you know, if they're worth their salt, don't believe in God. Well, here's an interesting, Anthony Flew. This is his book, which I have. He was called, the most notorious atheist. But in his later years, before he died, he became a believer. He said, what? Now, a lot of people say, he wrote this book. And a lot of people say, well, he's got senile. And he said, no, I was in my right senses when I wrote this book, and my change in faith became because of reason. He says, we have all the evidence we need in our immediate experience, and that only a deliberate refusal to look is responsible for atheism of any variety. Did you see that? He says, when you are a scientist and you have an open and honest mind, the evidence is everywhere, and it's only the person that refuses to look that becomes an atheist. Now, what's he telling us? A former atheist, a scientist. You're an atheist by choice. That's what he's saying. It's a belief system because you refuse to look at the evidence, so you choose to believe there is no God. And so that somehow makes him go away. And so it's not only him. We have other writers. Timothy Keller writes a great book. I suggest you get it. Reason for God in an Age of Skepticism. You should read his, The Language of Science by Francis Collins, and we'll talk about him in a second. He's the one that pioneered the Human Genome Project,
where they map all the DNA and all the information that is in our DNA. It was, you know, breakthrough discovery. It's been many years. This guy, you know, you don't get any smarter than him. Just want to set him up that way.
He's a scientist. And he says, according to surveys that he's found, 40% of scientists believe in a powerful, all-creating God who answers prayer. Now, that last part is the most important, because a lot of people are deists. What's a deist?
They believe in a creator who walks away and just lets nature take over and has a hands-off approach. What he's saying is 40% of scientists, from surveys that he's seen, not only believe in a creator, but believe that he's personally involved in your life. He answers your prayer. How can you be a scientist come to that conclusion? Because he uses reason. It's reasonable.
And so don't listen to this nonsense that all scientists reject a faith in God. He says, speaking of how advances in science present an opportunity, is what he says, for worship rather than a catalyst for doubt.
I want you to just think about that. The more we learn about true science, it does not create doubt. It gives us an opportunity to worship. Yeah. And I just suggest, how many people take work off work tomorrow? Oh, yeah, good for you. And I noticed my bank, they're not even opening until afternoon because they're giving their employees the chance to go out and look at the solar eclipse. Now, that's an amazing thing that some of us will never see another one in our lifetime. But when you look at it and you marvel at, you know, when it gets dark and all that, just pause and remember to praise God.
Amen.
Who made it all. Because it's those moments when we get to look and peer into the heavens and realize it's a God who made this ordered world. The heavens and the earth declare his handiwork. We have to be the kind of people that are willing to listen to the evidence that's before us.
It's not crazy. Here's a movie you should watch. God is not dead. It's a good movie for you to watch. It's almost like the cycle's changing. It's becoming favorable or okay to believe in God. And there's a lot of material and even in social media that will give you, again, that permission. I went too far ahead. First of all, I want you to just consider this point. Since we already know there's a God,
we have to find reason to believe in God. Say, what? What are you trying to say?
What we're suggesting in this morning's lesson is you have to find a reason that gives you permission to believe in God that you already know exists. Say, well, what are you talking about? We already read
JC, in Romans chapter 1, but I want you to open your Bibles there again and just consider what Paul's proposition is.
Now, Paul was a learned man himself, taught at the feet of Gamaliel. He understood the sciences as much as they did back then.
But he makes this interesting comment about the wrath of God in verse 18. He said, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, because what do they do? What does it say? They suppress the truth in their ungodliness or their unrighteousness. Well, what truth? Verse 19. Because that which is known about God, Paul says, is evident. And it's evident within them. For God has made it evident to them. So here is going to be my proposition. I cannot prove to you there is a God. Because when you're talking about proof, we're looking at scientific things like taking a photograph or presenting God before you, showing a videotape, or subjecting some type of scientific testing according to, you know, the norms of research. It's not possible because God lives outside the realms of nature and time and dimension. I cannot give you scientific proof that he exists. But guess what? I don't have to. Because Paul is arguing you already know by your own reason by your own logic, by growing up in his creation, you know there is a God. He's already evident in you. You say, well, this is circular reasoning. We'll come back to it next week and give you scientific evidence that confirms your faith. But I just want to argue with you. You have to give yourself permission to believe there's a God. Because if you close your mind to the possibility, you won't believe in him whether he just walks right in front of you. Jesus encountered the same attitude, didn't he? In John chapter 12, we'll study next week in our morning adult class, which I invite you to. He said, even though he's performing so many signs, those were miracles to prove his deity, it says they were not believing in him. And it was to fulfill what Isaiah said, that he hardened their hearts. So if your heart is closed, it doesn't matter if Jesus walks on the water, raises someone from the dead, you're not going to believe in him. They tried it. They killed it because of their lack of belief. So it's not about evidence, is it? It starts with having the right heart and the mind that's willing to look at the evidence and make a conclusion. Verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen through what has been made. Now, Lord willing, next week we'll look at the argument of design. We'll look at the argument from first cause. And we'll look at the finely tuned world in which we live. All point to what he's saying here. That you know there's a God. It's so obvious, he says, they are without excuse. So that's why, again, I rest on my proposition. I cannot prove that God exists according to the way science once proved. And I don't need to, because everyone already they just have to find reason to believe in God. Verse 21, even though they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks. See, that's a choice, isn't it? When you confront God and you choose not to honor him or thank him, he says they became futile in their speculations. We'll talk about some of the foolish speculations about this world and how it got here. And their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to become wise, they become fools. And they exchanged the glory of God for an incorruptible God, for an image of a corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. There's what Paul argues. Well, what is the reason I need to have to believe there is a God? First of all, can we just admit God's existence is either true or false? It's binary. There's no little gods, in-between gods. Either he's an all-powerful, omnipotent creator of all things, or he doesn't exist at all. That's only really two options. Would you all agree? And so the question is, if you have this attitude that God already exists, and we know that, then it's going to validate all the rational evidence that you've already been presented with. But if you take it the opposite view, that there is no God, you're going to come up with the exact opposite understanding. As we just demonstrated, Jesus had to deal with that. Now, when we look at that, some people do not want to believe. That's the problem. They don't want to believe. And you ask, well, why? Because they don't want to be accountable. Because they want to be God of their own life. Because if there is a God, that means they're going to be subject to him, and they're going to have to either have heaven or hell. They don't want to be accountable. Now, there are others that have encountered roadblocks in their faith. Now, those are the people that I suggest that have good hearts, but they have roadblocks. What's a roadblock? Well, you're going down a road, and it'll say detour because there's some problem in the road ahead, and you got to take a left turn or right turn. A lot of people, that happens with their faith. They're going along doing just fine, believing in God, and it all makes sense. It's rational. But then they hit a roadblock, and they go, oh, and they end up way over here to the left. What are these roadblocks? We'll talk about them. The solution is, as Tim Keller talks about, is learn to doubt your doubts. You say, what are you talking about? I'll explain what I mean by that. Let's look, first of all, some of the obstacles to belief. There's strong atheism, and what it It's not atheism that says, well, I don't believe in God because I don't see enough evidence to believe in him. A strong atheist is one that says, I know there is no God, absolutely. I've searched the whole world, the universe out, and I know there is no God.
Now remember Francis Collins? I talked about the head of the Genome Project. He says, you got to think about science when it comes to talking about spiritual things. It's useless. Because science deals with what? Physical things, this world of, you know, dimension of time and space, matter and energy. But when it comes to the spiritual, what can science offer to you as far as making determination if there is, even is a spiritual realm? Nothing. And so it's useless as a tool. It's the wrong tool altogether. He says God is at least in part outside of nature, unless you're a pantheist. Science is limited in its tools that are only appropriate for the exploration of nature. That's why they can tell you when the solar eclipse occurred, because the laws of physics help them get it down to the exact moment. But that's science of nature. Science, therefore, certainly never discount the possibility of something. Science can therefore certainly never discount the possibility of something outside of nature. To do so, he says, is category error, basically using the wrong tools to ask the question.
Basically, we ask this: can science determine for you if there's a God or not? The answer is what? No. They can point one way or the other, but anyone that says science has proven there is no God is guilty of what is called the universal negative. Now, in mathematics, there's a premise, the universal negative. For example, a triangle cannot have four sides. That's a universal negative. Now, why do we say that? It's true everywhere all the time. Because a triangle is defined by three sides. So can a triangle ever have four sides? No. So you're saying universally true everywhere, anywhere, in the past, in the present, in the future, that's a universal negative. So as Chesterton said, atheism is the most daring of all dogmas. We'll talk about dogmas in a second. Because they make this assertion, universally, there is no God. Now, I just want to debunk this right now. Because when you consider how much we really know scientifically, and we're talking about in a world of just amazing size and scope, and now they're talking about quantum physics and nanos and things that they didn't even understand. Well, Bertrand Russell says, what science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know. That's the attitude of scientists. You only know what science tells you. But I'm going to counter that with what this man said. I think he was pretty smart. He says, we still not know 1/1000th of 1% of what nature has revealed to us. 1/1000th of 1% of what, that's all we know. So let's put it into pie graph. If we were going to show you a graph of all the knowledge that we have, the blue would be that sliver of knowledge. Now, the yellow would be what we think we know, which isn't so. Because has science ever changed their mind about things? Well, Galileo was a good example. We thought once we were the center of the solar system, we found out that's not the case. Science is always changing their mind, but they're very good at telling you this is the way it is until they learn it's not. And then they don't do a retraction. They just say, well, this is the way it is. Now, that's okay because science is exploring a God-ordered world, the laws that God has put into place. And so it's because it's so infinite, you would not expect them to know everything. But the red is what we don't know. Would you agree with that? There's so much we don't know. They don't know why gravity pulls. They're not sure if light is energy or matter. They can measure it. But there's so many questions they have. They have no clue how life originated on this earth. And so when you make an assertion that I know there is no God, are you speaking a little too flamboyantly? Because your box is really little, your box of knowledge. And and you're making an assertion about a box that is much bigger than you, saying, I've investigated all things, and I know there is no God.
You're making a universal negative, and that's pretty presumptuous on your part. Collins writes, suppose the knowledge that demonstrates that God exists is outside your limited knowledge. Suppose the evidence you're looking for is out here. And you say, I know he doesn't exist. Isn't that a little unreasonable? Isn't it? No, a little unreasonable.
It's downright wrong to make that assertion. That's the world that's so bold today. And I just want to arm you with these two things. Just to show you it's okay to believe in God, because science really does not have a clue. Do not listen to them in these matters. Now, with that saying, there's some obstacles to our faith that we call dogmas. Now, a dogma, you have to understand, is just a principle, a belief that you have determined is absolute. Now, for Christians, do we have certain dogmas that we absolutely hold to be true? Jesus is the Son of God. I mean, that's foundational. It cannot change. He rose from the dead. God is a spirit. There are certain things we hold to be true without controversy. Now, do you understand that atheism has dogmas as well? They have beliefs that they hold to be true, and you can't discuss them. And I have a list of some of them. Everything has a natural cause. We call that a naturalist, or someone that is given to materialism. That the only person that believes in a God, because they look at this world and ask, how did it happen? They believe in God because they don't have the answer yet. Science's job is to give the answer how it happened, because there's always a natural cause, so you don't need God. He's called God of the gaps. You made him up to fill up your ignorance. Well, science has this presupposition that every problem can be solved with a natural explanation. So because of that, they believe miracles are impossible. Now, did Jesus encounter that problem? He did a miracle, and they still didn't believe him. And so when you believe that, and you show something that looks supernatural, the naturalist or the scientist or the atheist will reject it. Well, there has to be a natural explanation. It looks miraculous, but it's not. And so here's another one. A loving God would not allow suffering or evil to exist. Now, where do you read that in the journals of science that that's been proven? That a loving God would not allow, a loving, all-powerful God would not allow suffering to exist. How do we know that's true? But that's accepted as an ironclad evidence that there is no God. Are you with me? And we'll explain that in just a little bit. And then with that comes, there is no absolute truth, or there can't be one exclusive religion. Behind every doubt that you encounter or people throw at you is an alternate belief of something else to be held to be true. Behind every doubt is an alternate belief of something which is held as true. And I want to explain that by giving some example. First of all, naturalism is a belief there's only the natural world and not any supernatural one. That's why they believe miracles are impossible. So if you already believe that miracles are impossible, and someone presents you a miracle, are you going to doubt it? Why? Because you've already chose to believe that there's only a natural world and not a supernatural one. You can't believe the miracle because of your preconceived belief that they're impossible. One removes the possibility of the second. So it's not a matter about, is a miracle possible? It's all a matter of the heart. You with me? So we want to give some examples then. Here, what we have to do is examine our doubts when they're presented to you for validity. In other words, when I say examine them, when someone says, prove to me there's a God, prove to me that Jesus is the Christ, and when they say that, they want really ironclad, consistent evidence, and you're put on the spot to provide it, or they'll say, see, your faith is just a leap. Well, what we want to do is turn the tables. When someone tells me something like there is no possibility of miracles, where's your proof for that? You see, that's your belief system that causes you to negate any evidence I give you.
So I'm going to demand from you
the same type of evidence you're asking for me for your beliefs.
And when we do that, you can learn to doubt your doubts. For example, loving God would not allow suffering or evil to exist. The question I have to ask is that a fact?
Or is it just a belief that I hold?
Because the underlying belief to that statement, the objection to there being a God, is there's no reason that an all-powerful or loving God would allow suffering to exist. That's the underlying belief. Because they argue suffering does exist, therefore God does not.
How do you know there's no reason a loving, all-powerful God would not allow suffering? How do you know that's true? What doesn't make sense to me? Isn't that really the answer? Well, wait a second. When a child is sent to his room, what are they going to ask? Why? And the parent gives them an answer, because you bit your brother and I told you not to 15 times. Go to your room. I don't understand. A loving mom would not alienate me from the rest of the family. Now, from a little child, might they not have that type of attitude? So their belief system negates a loving mom being possible. How do you know there's not a reason a loving God would not allow suffering? How do we know that to be true? We don't. It's just sometimes we're too immature to understand his wisdom in allowing it to happen.
There are good answers for it.
But we have to start doubting our doubts by identifying the underlying belief system that we hold
and then ask, is that just an assumed belief or is it something that is actually true? Let me give you another example. I can't accept the God who sent people to hell. We'll take that one first of all. What's the underlying belief to that?
You hear that a lot. It's an objection to God. A loving God would not send people to hell forever and ever and ever. Well, the underlying belief is that eternal punishment is unjust. It's not justice. It's too severe of a crime or time for the crime that was committed. Isn't that the underlying belief system? Well, how far do you go with that? That's the same argument when people say capital punishment is unfair or unjust. They say the penalty is too severe for the crime. It's the same argument that you hear about child molestation or people molesting children. The argument is how much penalty should we associate to this crime that has devastated this person's life and they'll deal with it through the rest of their life, through adulthood. And they argue about what is just. 5 years, 10 years, what is it? And so
that's what someone's
wrestling with when they say a loving God would not send someone to hell forever, because they're thinking that's not just. The problem is what? They don't understand the seriousness of the crime. They don't understand how terrible sin is. And if you had the mind of God and you could get out of the sliver of knowledge we had and had a more encompassing knowledge, you realize, that is terrible. I understand now why a person is separated forever from the loving God. You would understand it.
But yet we assume things, and therefore we reject the truth. How about God? A loving God wouldn't allow homosexuals to marry? Did you hear that one today? What's the underlying belief there?
Two loving adults should be able to do as they wish. That's the underlying belief that someone holds to be true. Now, how far do you go with that? Loving adults or adults should be allowed to do whatever they do. Do we allow our children to do anything they want to do? No. And do we punish our children sometimes when they do repeatedly the same thing over and over? Yeah. So we have to ask, what is the basis for believing that's true, that adults can do anything they want to do? Maybe an all-wise, loving God knows better. And that's why he says,
don't bite your brother, or don't sleep with someone of the same sex. So when we consider these things, you say, this is just kind of a more of a philosophical argument. It is, because it starts with the heart and the head. And so here's what I just want to leave with you. Learn to ask the tough questions and demand honest and consistent answers. It's interesting, atheists stop thinking. And I don't say that. When it comes to the big questions, how did I get here? What am I here for? Where am I going? How do I know right and wrong? They stop thinking because they don't have answers to those questions that are consistent. They don't have a clue to answer them, so they stop asking them, stop thinking. But God asks you, and Christ demands that we think even more. We ask those questions. How did I get here? What am I here for? How do I know right from wrong? Where am I going? How can I assure that I'm going to go there? And so start thinking for yourselves. It's amazing how we send our children to school and to universities, and they're not taught to think analytically and to reason and to question. And so a lot of people become lazy when it comes to be thinking. They don't want to ask tough questions because it requires tough, strong, honest answers, and that takes work. So when we look at these things, it's fair to ask them. And we need to deal with them. And God's going to give the only right answer. The existence of God is the only consistent, reasonable answer to all these questions. When you take atheism and naturalism, you get no consistent answers to any of these questions. So again, it's reasonable to believe there is a God. For example, why is something right or wrong? Here's a Russian philosopher. He's satirically making fun of an atheist. He says, man descended from apes, therefore we must love one another. Now, the first part is evolution, right? There is no God, so man descended from apes. Therefore, you should love one another. Now, how'd you get from A to B? But most people in the world that are atheists or naturalists, they believe we should not hurt one another, we should love one another. Where'd you come up with that morality from we descended from apes? Because when you look at apes and naturalism and survival of the fittest, what does nature teach us? Isn't it natural for the strong to eat the weak? That's what he's arguing. And that's the way it was in the past, so why aren't we allowed to do it now? Is that a fair question? If you do not believe in God, and you believe you're an evolved animal, and it's survival of the fittest, and you used to eat the weaker, and that's how you became who you are, why can you not continue to do that? What's the basis for saying that's all of a sudden wrong? They have none. You ask them, and they cannot provide one. And I say that absolutely. They cannot give you a basis for morality. And they say, we don't think. We don't use our brain. I'm asking you to think more. Challenge people. So when we look at these things, I'll leave you with this. And this will be introduction to next week. Like we give the fun stuff, the evidence that, oh, there has to be a God that points to it. If we took you into the street of dreams, and we walked in a new house that had all the new technology, it's a smart home. We had smartphones, now we have smart refrigerators, now we have smart homes. So you walk in the door, and isn't this amazing? The structure has a door. When you walk up to it, it opens for you. You didn't know you had a little ID card that sends who you are. Isn't that amazing? And then you walk in, and all of a sudden someone says, hello, Jack, how are you? What can I do for you? Wow, where did that come from? Someone's talking to me. It must be a God. You know, you walk through it, and you discover all the amazing things of technology. You look over here, and what's that? There's cold air blowing out of the floor. Isn't that amazing? It's so hot outside, but somehow there's this hole in the ground there, and cold air is coming out. Isn't that amazing how that happened just by coincidence? You go, coincidence? Well, yeah, because I went on a trip, and this house was not here. I came back, and I heard you had a storm, and there used to be a bunch of trees here, and there was a big windstorm, and now there's this house. Well, no, someone built it. No, I don't see any builder. I don't even see any
proof of a designer, an architect. It wasn't here, and now it is. And you're walking through, and you open this door, and you go, look, there's cold drinks in here. How did it keep it at the right temperature? And you shut it, and you open the other door. Look, there's ice cream here. This door keeps it colder below 32, and this one keeps it at 34. Isn't it amazing how coincidences happen? Now, are you going to start worrying about that person? As they go through the house and they turn on the stereo or watch the TV, and they just say, look at this, there's a translucent, it's this material, but it's hard, but you can see through it. And it's right in the right place that I can see outside. It's amazing what windstorms can do. Then finally you pick up a guitar. Who plays guitar? All right, I know you play it well, all right? A car that's not tuned, what does it sound like? Terrible. When it's out of tune, right? You strum a ding, right? But when it's finely tuned and all the notes are in pitch, it makes a beautiful sound. Because every string is a note in a chord, right? And they harmonize perfectly. So this person walks over and says, look, what is this thing? And he picks it up, he's never seen a guitar. And he goes, bling, it's beautiful. It's because it's finely tuned, pitch perfect. This is just beats all things. This is more amazing than the lunar eclipse. Look, this thing has wire strings on it, and when you hit it, they're all in tune and make beautiful music. Isn't it amazing what time and chance can do? And you say, whoa, I'm sorry, this enough of this nonsense. That was tuned by someone. That was finely tuned. And the fact that it is tuned demands you accept someone tuned it, right? It didn't happen by chance. They go, no. I don't believe in architects. I don't believe in engineers or builders. They're not possible. And so they go along thinking that it just happened by accident. Next week, Lord willing, we'll walk through the house called God's universe. We'll see the marvelous things that it offers to us that point to a creator, a builder, an architect, someone with infinite wisdom. We'll look at how the universe is finely tuned, and there's so many constants that if you change them in the slightest bit, we could not exist. And all scientists agree they're true, and they're trying to understand, how could this be? It looks like someone tuned it, but we don't believe in a God. And they stop thinking because of it, because they don't have an answer. And I'll give you their silly answer next week. But that's the world in which we live in. God has created it for our enjoyment, for our beauty, but to point our eyes and our hearts to God himself. You already know, don't you, there's a God. You know. Just find reason to believe in him and start doubting your doubts and dismissing those obstacles the world puts in front of us by asking tough questions and being true to yourself. And it doesn't hurt to pray to the Almighty God. This is my prayer often. God, please, I live in a world of doubt, a world of uncertainty, a world that denies your existence. God, I'm seeking you so I can find you. God, I need to see you in this world. Please show yourself to me so I can grow in my faith. That's a prayer you can pray, because God will allow himself to be found by those who are seeking him. And you can know assuredly that there is a God. We're going to sing that song. There is, beyond the Asher Boom, a God. He is alive. Shall we stand as we sing this song?
There is.